1, 2, 3, 4.
Patrick Healy's novel, Beyond the Pale, explores memory, time, childhood, and how language shapes our world. Set in rural Ireland, starting in the 1950s, the book follows a young boy's early memories through a series of expressionistic soundscapes. The expression from which the book takes its name has now come to mean beyond what is considered acceptable behaviour. But the origins of the phrase referred to land within Ireland that was beyond the control of the English government. Healy's book examines social class, stigma, village and family life, identity, and the nature of consciousness. Rooted in the oral tradition, Beyond the Pale is a celebration of place, the Irish idiom, music, and memory. Patrick Healy was born in Dublin in 1955. He studied philosophy and Semitic languages at St. Columban's Dalgan Park, Pontifical University Maynooth, and University College Dublin. He has published over 20 books on topics around artists, aesthetic theory, philosophy of science, architecture, art criticism, and innumerable essays. He has been a professor of interdisciplinary research at Free International University Amsterdam from 1997 and was a senior research fellow at the Faculty of Architecture from 2020 to 2022. He is currently completing a new work of fiction entitled Fatal Fragments, a loose follow-up to Beyond the Pale. Patrick Healy, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you very much.
I've just been reading your book, Beyond the Pale, and of course, many might know you for your philosophical writings, your academic work, your translations, also your paintings, because you're quite a Renaissance figure. But your fiction has been something that you kind of keep it secret. And so it was such a pleasure to be immersed in this world of Beyond the Pale. And before we get into the conversation, you were born in Ireland. I lived for a number of years in Ireland. I don't know it as well as you, but you create this whole sensory world, this sonic landscape that maybe readers aren't familiar with because this world is kind of vanishing. You know, when you were born, or it was early 1950s, you move around in time in the book, but you create this sense of an Ireland that we may have forgotten.
Yes.
At this time, Ireland was one of the poorest countries in Europe. It's hard to believe the Celtic Tiger now, but unemployment was high, the church loomed large over every aspect of life. Just to set this up with this world at that time, religion and deep belief in the afterlife is shaping the way people thought and acted, and society wasn't as grounded in the material world as it is today. And you really recreate. It was such a pleasure to go back to this world where technology is barely there and the freedom of technology was great, among the many other things. We've seen a lot of changes, 70 years of television and social media, not just in Ireland, but around the world. But at that time, people were less Americanized. And the language, you've got a great ear for the language, the way people spoke, and you find it in pockets around Ireland. You recreate all of that, this very vibrant, idiosyncratic way of speaking, where the publicans could be poets, the shopkeepers can be like philosophers. You tune into it very well. Instead of me telling you about the history of Ireland, tell listeners to give an overview of a little bit of that 700 years of colonial occupation, what your book Beyond the Pale is touching upon.
Well, thank you. I mean, obviously, your not being Irish doesn't mean I think that you don't grasp a book as well as somebody who is Irish. For years and years and years, there was always this idea that people in Dublin automatically knew what James Joyce was writing, which meant often they didn't have to read it. And so for years and years, there was people, you know, talking about Ulysses who would then perhaps privately say to you later, well, actually, they'd read a little bit of it, but they hadn't read all of it. And, you know, so I think that I don't want to make any particular claims about the fact that I was born in Ireland as giving me a more privileged access to what's written. And I would like to think that what's written is available, and that should be part of the achievement of the book, that somebody who knows absolutely nothing about the kind of characters or people that are inhabiting those pages, nevertheless, can hear things. And I liked your phrase very much, this sonic landscape, because I did always think of it as, and it comes up in the book at some stage, as the Isle of Voices, the Isle of Sounds. It's a Shakespearean, obviously, source for that. But Ilona Vuchana in Irish, you could translate that as Isle of Sounds. And I think that's one of my sort of big sense, that all people remain memorable to you through intonation, through phrase, through turn of phrase. There was an enormous value placed on somebody being able to say something either witty or interesting or slightly exaggerated. There was a kind of open transmission of a kind of rhetorical capacity among people in general. It wasn't, I mean, I take your point about the technology and the point about the Catholic influence. That's more of kind of the ideological bedrocks, or the lack of one, you could say, in one instance. But you still find that it's about talking.
Yeah, and perhaps we should say, really, it's all music. I find this to be a very musical book. We should also say, Beyond the Pale, not everyone knows it. The Pale is a place. Just tell us about that, what that is, what that means.
Yeah. The Pale was literally the place of the strongest English influence within Ireland. And it ran from the East Coast, from Dundalk, included parts of Westmeath, all the way down to Kilkenny. The North County of Dublin, Fingal, preserved features of both language and idiolect, which go back to the time of Shakespeare, to 16th century English. I mean, the village that's really the key character in the book, Balruthery, it's in North County Dublin. It was an Anglo-Norman foundation. The name means the town of the knights. And a lot of the names of people that occur in the book are local names, many of which can be traced back to even late medieval period. And you don't start getting family names until the late medieval period in Ireland. But these names like Purfield and Plant and Wade and Desperate and Marmion sound slightly French or Norman or Irish Norman. On the village green, when I was a kid, people played cricket. And this was considered quite unusual because in Ireland, sports had become an issue of national identification, whether you played Cathbella, football, Gaelic football, soccer, rugby, cricket, and certain games were said to be favored by one social group and other games were played by another social group, largely poorer and Catholic. There was a kind of strange thing because golf was in between. On the mainland of Europe, people playing golf tends to be from rather elitist sport, whereas in Ireland, golf became a generalized sport that anyone played, but cricket did. Cricket still had this connection with Charles Stewart Parnell played cricket, or, you know, cricket was an ascendancy game, or Gaelic football was for people who were not of that. So things that seem quite simple in a way about games point to you about the historical complexity of the place, that people would come in from picking potatoes in the field and then to don themselves in cricket whites, beautifully dressed, and play cricket for a whole summer afternoon. People would have lemonade and picnics. The next day, the same group of people who had played together would be going to a different church to worship.
There's a lot of different social cues. It's interesting how that's all embedded within the landscape, within the sport, which I hadn't realized that. And you talk about naming, whether it's place names, family names. That's a big part of this book. We understand and kind of own it. You know, we have different names for the same thing.
Yeah.
And where did your fascination with the beauty, the music of language begin? Can you trace it back?
Well, I think that something in the book has to do with memory. But it isn't just memory relating to place. It's also memory relating to sounds or to phrases. So I was very fascinated as a child as to why, when you were learning the alphabet, you were shown a picture of a donkey. You know, D is for donkey or G is for goose. And it fascinated me that you could recognize from a drawing an animal you had seen, but also an animal you hadn't seen. So that if you showed a child of 3 or 4 a book of dinosaurs, they still knew they were animals, even though they'd never seen these animals, because the association of an actual alphabet letter with a picture, and later then with a sound, became very fascinating. And at the same time, you were learning to write. And as you may remember, one of the biggest achievements when you were about 3 or 4 in writing is that you write your own name, and that there's a certain, it's even before you can keep a secret from your mother, you have this secret moment when you can write out your name as whatever it is. And I think that these were kind of, if you like, the memories of where you begin to feel that you've started to live, that this is you. This is not other people calling you. This is you rising yourself in a movement of the hand with a pen. Usually it had a nib. You often talked about the nib getting sprained, and you had to dip it into a small white enamel inkwell, as it was called, which was inserted into the top of the desk, which had a slanting cover on it. And you dipped the pen in and you wrote in a line jotter book your name. And you would write it out maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 times. And at that stage, a teacher, this was in what was called baby infants at the age of 4, not high infants. Miss O'Carroll was the teacher. And if you wrote very well, you were given a gold star. So there was some, if you like, it's setting you on a kind of path where you're meant to achieve things, where you're supposed to be doing, you get rewarded, you write your name. And the repetition of this was like you say to yourself, you know, I am this, I am what I write.
Yeah. And of course, well, we don't have to say it's the Irish are known the world over for the way you talk about turn of phrase, the way they could use language. And there's so many sentences within your book, Beyond the Pale, that are like, I haven't read that sentence before. It's not like, you know, and I can't memorize them because they're so unique. They're their own shape. They're their own word. In fact, a paragraph is being like its own word, right? Yeah. And all these special words, that there's a word for things that you wouldn't even think there would be a word for. And you, of course, speak many languages, so it's about mixing words and meanings. And you have a whole sequence about the making of the stew and the secret of life is mixing. And I don't want to be down on the way things are now, where efficiency seems to be everything, but we seem to be reducing things down to the most basic level of communication. The value of a unique phrase that no one else could say isn't valued as much as something like the cliche that everyone gets because they don't even think, they just receive it.
Yeah. It opens with, I mean, what I suppose for an Irish book is a rather unusual situation. It is somebody called the Count Taff, who is an Irish Austro-aristocrat who lives in the local area. And he's teaching this young boy Japanese whilst he's making a consommé. But the point about the mix of the ingredients is he's making a consommé, he's not making a stew. And the word satura or satar actually comes from a stew where you put a lot of ingredients together. But the process here is to take a lot of ingredients and to distill it down. So the distillation process is almost like an alchemical process. It's about the way in which through the filters of the language being learned and through the child's listening, whereby he takes the phrase sore, sore, he knows that that's the word sure, sure in English pronunciation. So he's using other language to remember words in language. And in the space between, of course, he's beginning to develop actually a kind of satire. He's becoming humorously dislocated from the very language in which he's becoming fluent. And this parallels the way in which his own naming is a double naming, because what is discovered in the book much, much later, somebody is sitting in what is presumably Port Tran, which was called a mental hospital. And in those days, you could be institutionalized, was the phrase used. But it wasn't always that people were locked up for, you know, there were sort of day, you could be let out, or you could go in for a while and come out, or there were all kinds of different levels of engagement in the institution itself in the local area. And it was half spoken about, was half mentioned, it was considered slightly shameful.
The process of naming is really important throughout the book, in particular to a central emotional story of a character in the novel who has two names.
Somehow, an older version of what looks like an eraser seems to be talking about the fact that there was a double name due to the fact that this is a foster family and is not the child's biological mother and so on and so forth. But that, according to the custom, the official name of the birth cert is kept in the school register, and he has the family name. So he has a double name problem, a little bit like the problem of a double language, of there being Irish and English. There's two names, there's two languages, and there's constant movement in between both of these, so that you are both, and you are neither one nor the other.
It's interesting. I spoke yesterday with a writer who's a twin, and I know it's a heard in some other works where you did translations, this twinning aspect. And also in this book, it's a lot about the dream life. You have the real life, and it seems like there's this dream world that's woven as well. There's a lot of echoes.
That's it. I think one Irish writer once said, you don't finish books, they abandon you. John McGahan, I think it was, I'm not quoting him exactly, but it's that idea. At a certain point, you have to say, Schluss, that's it, or aus. You have to get out of it in some way. Because you can see that even though there are no great events occurring in the book, or there's no massive narration being piled up sequentially, it's a kind of, it's both episodic and you don't know what's coming next. Because voices just suddenly enter, and they're not given double quote marks. You almost have no single quote marks. You get to know the voices because of how the characters earlier have been introduced. So you know this is something from the parish priest, or from Father O'Brien, or from Molly Eustace, or from Mrs. Marmion, or the various named people who are coming in and out of the book, who have certain interests, comments, Mr. Dunn on the flower, on the usage of for the flower show, the foster mother herself, who doesn't actually say very much within the book, but you get quite a lot of movement now, not only between the different language worlds, but also between the characters, because the characters are mostly real names of people, but on the other hand, some of them are inventors. So there is again a play of invention and reality.
I think that now would be a good time to hear you read some passages to just to give that flavor, because I think like Joyce, we can understand it on the page, but we can understand it so much better when you sing the words. And if you could just set up, just to give a little bit of background.
In order to do this as the game it should be, I just thought it might be good just to, it used to be an old game in Roman literature that you would open a book anywhere and the passage should sort of tell you something. People used to do this with, this was the first printout I did when I was finished. So what I'm going to do is this. I've now opened a page. And
yes.
Is that okay? Do you
mind? I love that game. I play that quite often. We should say also, because of the way this is written and the way, because there's so many wonderful corners and pockets, and wherever you land will be interesting.
Okay. Herr Ol Ilan Angel, noble Ireland, Isle of Angels. Didn't the Pope call two slave boys in Rome the same? Gli, Angeli. Maybe it was all one Dwangeli. We are the Dwanglies, the Pritto Britto, Angle Langle, Brilla, men are happy, 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 thus committing adultery. You might as well rave there as in bed. Have you ever heard of a prey of horses? Indeed, an ounce of gold for every nose in Ireland. That was the Fomorian tribute. If she didn't have to mind Jane, she would have been an archaeologist, swears by the O'Rahilly, and is reading it constantly. Maybe that's why they say you end up paying through the nose. You're having me on, pull the other. Agus ingi doctor gok shroneren, an ounce of gold for every nose in Ireland. Then there is, that is there in the book Fintan then say, it will belong to clerics to the end of time. No keeping them fed. I tell you there are bells and angels all right, but don't worry. On the last day, all will be sorted out, and Periwinkle Tom will lead a chorus. Oh, keep from the lake where 900 of the youth of Ireland drowned, and from the river where the king's daughter was swept away. He will prophesy in the lake of no birds and make offerings like Hannibal. We shall hear them rattle in the house of bleached bones, sing in the hall of lyres, give judgment in the house of torts. We had only two claims, either it was from the nobles of Spain or via the Phoenicians. It's only with the old English, who are the new Irish, that the claims of the Celtic came about. You can thank Father Keating for that. I can't make head nor tail of this. What are you going on about? Sealy, that is Seal Island, a wild bluff out there and speaking with a loud voice but without an evil word. Gun goto mor gun drok fuckel. After the storm, masses of seaweed driven into the shore, the perchman holds up the seaweed with his pole when it arrives, and then it has to be moved before the next tide. But if there is not much, the weed is divided into pennies, yes, pinyin, and the land for the manure into rigs and ridges. Didn't you hear tell of that before? I might have. The fire is smouldering, it's smoured by the Son of Mary. There is an angel in the door by the door of every house. The cawing and crowing sounds never end under those. You are right, I must remember them. Tie a knot there, and I'll have it again. So there you have, of course, the whole issues of the different languages interplaying with each other, little scraps of Irish languages, idioms. I have stories that are being told historically about how Ireland actually comes about as an idea, as to where the Irish come from. So a lot of these kind of debates are just taking place, you know, in day-to-day conversation. And then they trail off. People start something, they trail off. They might come back to it later. That phenomenon of, you know, speaking over each other, telling tales that are known, not known, I found always very interesting in Ireland. It was literally like a radio, you know, radio kept on all day in the kitchen. You would come in and out, and you would hear certain things, and you'd have to work out the context and the conversation and the speakers. In some way, one of the big personalities in the book is just a radio that's playing, and that some of these conversations are not actually taking place between characters in real time. They're just snippets that have been overheard on radios.
That open transmission. And it is a sense that you do get a lot in Ireland. If you travel around and you might have just met somebody and they're talking to you like you knew them for years, and then they're referring to old bits of history, your man who moved down the road, and you just have to be out on your toes and kind of like decipher this archaeology. So I do like that, the idea of it's a radio. And I sometimes wondered, was it like ghosts? Because you kind of hinted that at the end, like, you know, as it goes back to beginning. So I really like that. And I wondered, did you write it chronological? You know, you opened there and in the middle. Do you want to read some more?
She stood at the jamb of the door. She did nothing. Musty sighed to her, attached root, crabbed, gibbing. They called her a hex, preparing meals for the hens, selling eggs by the dozen. An old horse with a hollow back, fat as a goose. Twilight. Smell of old spice aftershave, strutting and straddle of bantam cocks. An unlikely pair, a fox, an eagle, hairy, lair, littered in a brake at the foot of a tree on which the eagle alighted to survey his prey. Awful racket. And a certain day, the fox being away, let me guess, the eagle swooped down on the cubs and took them to feed the eaglets. Fox could only curse on return. The nestlings. Soon after, eagle swooped down on an altar where meat for the sacrifice was being burnt on a brand like a stick. And lo and behold, it set fire to the nest. The eaglets fell to the ground, and the fox ate them in the very sight of the eagle. Oh, to hear again the homing rook, scone of a fat cabbage, peels of potatoes, left in a white enameled bucket with a wooden wire handle, and to think of her, she said, crumpled in piety, a silver sixpence with a greyhound. Now, if you can bend the iron bar and the fellow of that wheel. She coughed and rasped, bowing, stooping, holding a pitcher of milk, a pail of milk, and Periwinkle Tom with his sack of periwinkles, the milk settling in the pitcher, yellow of the cream hue as the cream settled. Leave her, and nothing of the stammer word for heartburn, pharmacopoeia. We must rack the flower beds with seaweed and ask for help from Periwinkle Tom. Doncy, dill, dingle and dung, dingle, doncy, dung and dale. Oh, the doncy fellow called a dingle a dale and said it's yellow.
That's great. I mean, it's so much poetry. And it brings you back to this kind of also the farming history and the knowledge of the land and the nature. And, you know, a lot of that's lost. You've had that growing up. But
some people said we were very influenced by Joyce. And I said, well, I mean, Joyce influences everything ever afterwards, of course, as a writer. But this is not set in the city. This is not among urban intellectuals. This is not in sort of the modern setting of an advertising canvasser and sophisticated people having adulterous affairs. And so this is actually set in the countryside, and, you know, where the intelligentsia, if you like, is the local vet, the chemist, the priests, the school teacher, and that there is a very almost strong relationship to them as keepers of collective memory. People are always kind of looking out. So this greyhound on the sixpence is an actual coinage of the time, a rail. which probably comes from the Spanish real, which comes up in the book. That's discussed at quite some length. So all kinds of tiny fragments of material culture are given the same weight as verbal play between characters, and the verbal play between characters is given the same weight as snatches from a radio. And meanwhile, this is layered between different, if you like, tiers of memory, because we know from the beginning of the book that there's somebody learning Japanese, that this is actually the memory of a writer who has just died in Amsterdam, which an editor has started to work on. And we're given the first part of what would have been his book. But as the editor moves through the pages, because it's a very large manuscript, he loses control of the pages because he lets them fall on the ground and they haven't been numbered. So then episodes are beginning to hop in and out, and he has to occasionally make either comments or get help with it. And eventually it looks like it's kind of stabilizing itself, but only at about page 60. It starts to stabilize, and then you get these kind of episodic in and out. And there, it's, I suppose, the technique is more like in cinema, because you never know, actually, no matter how much you know in a film, you could never say, this is what the next scene is going to show. It's like when we speak. You can never say, this is the next sentence I'm going to speak. You can't do it. And that's, yeah, that process where we generate and transmit language, because we are spoken to, or we are named, and we are engaged constantly in this naming and speaking, as if we're trying to find out something, whereas in fact, we're perhaps just enjoying ourselves, like Beckett says, like with an itch. You know, it's just what we have to do, because we have a brain, and we just need to talk to find things out, to say things. And I think that's also part of what's in this book. I try to get as close to those processes as I can.
So, yeah, you really invite us in on these, though, of course, those exterior landscapes and those inner landscapes. And it does become this mystery, because when I was reading that part about the editor and stuff, and now it makes more, as you explain it now, that, oh, that aha, I can see. But it becomes all these layers of mystery, and then you have to go back to read and piece it together. And I know it's a trilogy as well, so then that will illuminate other, it's, you're working on the other parts of the trilogy. Yeah. You know, you mentioned their relationship, and I was thinking back to a conversation I had with this Dakota. He talking about radio, he runs a radio show, and he talks about the Dakota language being one of relationships. I think, and I don't know enough about the Irish language, but the way that you use it and the way I've heard other Irish people use it, it does feel to me like a language of relationships. I know that you have these special use of nouns and stuff, but the verbs, the relationships are important, so that it's a living language.
Well, for example, you've just said Dakota. That instantly triggers in my memory a song I heard as a kid in a film that I went to on a Sunday afternoon in Hamilton Cinema in the nearby town, and was "Take Me Back to the Black Hills of Dakota, to that beautiful Indian country that I love." So that is a word that has been in my head since I was 5 years of age. But I don't know anything about the Dakotan language, or I know a little bit about the Iroquois, because that's used, because the kid is interested in cowboys and Indians, so he knows something about bows and arrows. But that "Take Me Back to the Black Hills of Dakota," and it was sung by, I think, Doris Day. Now, I'm just guessing that, and if I'm right about that, that's just free memory that I should get that right. "To that beautiful Indian country that I love." So I suppose that echoes with a certain kind of idea of the place again, or what you call sonic landscape, of that you belong because you said the word. Or in the Hillbillies, they had this thing about gold, black tea, and, you know, because television was coming in. You were right to say that in your opening comments, because that did make an enormous difference. The Irish writer Martin O'Kane in the west of Ireland has a wonderful story about a motor car arriving on an island for the first time. But I think most people of my generation, I was born in 1955, will remember when a TV came into the house, and will remember that it was put on in the evening at news time or for the Angelus, and it wasn't on, you know, all over the weekend. You know, it still had a certain kind of it almost had this sort of, there was almost a superstitious space for us in what was called a sitting room. The sitting room usually had a cabinet of bits of porcelain, a radio, which was quite a piece of furniture in itself, made of mahogany with sort of little ivory knobs. Yeah, that fascinated me too, that as you could move the radio knobs across, you would see Spain and you would see Leipzig and places you suddenly, these are just words, but they're the rest of the world. Yeah, and you can hear bits of it. You hear the weather forecast in Spanish or some things.
The shipping news. Finisterre's gone now, I guess.
Fort Cromarty, southwest 6 continuous light rain, 1023 millibars rising slowly. And I loved the fact that the voice was going down as the word said rising slowly. So it ended on this dying fall. So there was something massively melancholic about the weather forecast. And these places sounded sort of so mythical and magical because you knew didn't know where they were. You were probably never going to go there. And now you tell me Finisterre has ended, since the name itself means the end of the earth, you know.
And Oxford's The Future of AI, The Future of Humanity Institute has also closed.
Well, it reminds me of what Heinrich Heine once said. He said that when the world comes to an end, I'm going to Holland. Everything happens 50 years later there.
Yes, so you are in Holland, if people haven't picked up. I think it's a good place to create. You've been teaching there for a number of years, teaching, writing, translating, painting.
Yeah.
You've gone into your creative cave there. I think it's been very good.
Yes.
You've always had this great creative energy, and I think also been a great presenter as well of other people's work. I remember you did that marathon recording of Finnegan's Wake in 4 days. But why did you decide to take this time? Now is Patrick time. Now I'm going to record these things.
Yeah, well, the question is very moot. Because the question is asking the question, why do we make a decision to do something like write a book or anything? And I think what you do is, but it's always after the event, you say, this happened, that happened, that happened, and I was doing this. But I think I always was doing this. I think I always had in my mind, not very fully expressed, but it was my mind that, you know, a lot of my life was spent under dual, I was like a dual national, I was like a double existence, like a secret agent or something. So, you know, I had this other name. So imagine some people knew me by the family name, some people knew me by my birth cert name. So then I come to them, someone says, why does he have another name? Has he done something strange? And suddenly you become a figure of suspicion. So I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated by the fact that you could be marginal simply because of something that people didn't understand, and because you didn't normally say, well, actually, my mother never got married and she wasn't well, and I had to be fostered as a child. And the foster parents were very loving and very kind and sweet people. And in a way, I suppose 50 years later, I'm saying thank you to people who are no longer alive as well. I mean, that's at a private level, if you like, of biography. But more interesting, it seemed to me, was that the situation, because when I first took lectures in philosophy in 1972, I remember I had a teacher, Gerald Bellew, Father Bellew, a priest. Most of the philosophy teachers I had were priests. But the big word he was using, 1972, existentialism. Now I listen to the news or something and everything is an existential crisis. Yeah, and everybody's talking about tropes and existential crisis. And certain words creep back. They seem to do an awful lot of work for a whole lot of other words that aren't said. But the thing I liked about my first reading, what is a great philosophical novel, and maybe one of the most successful ever written, La Nausée by Sartre, yeah, or his Les Mots, The Words, I really could identify with that. So perhaps, you know, I'm sort of 50 years out of date, but maybe 50 years surviving the end of the world, so maybe ahead of time. And that process that you're suddenly out of date, but suddenly things you're interested in become of interest to others again. There's so many different sliding chronologies going on as we speak. It's not just present, past, and future. There's things whose consequences you don't see until much later. Also, that's what it was about. Yeah, even in personal relationships, because I think it's always the case that the justice of love is higher than the romance of love.
Yeah.
What's the truth of all of this? At least you can walk away with that, yeah? The other situation just leaves you kind of, in a bad situation. And I think writing does that as well. It clears out. It allows things show themselves. So that when I was finished, and as I said earlier, when it abandoned me, for days, weeks, even in the last, I said, I forgot the word silver mint. Did I describe the Toblerone bar? Did I describe, the clove sweets with their red and white? And suddenly I was myself adding to and re-experiencing the memory. And it makes it easier if you come to terms with all that memory. It makes it easier just to live now.
Yeah.
Because the one thing about the future is that it's absolutely certain, that is, we won't be around after a certain amount of time. So that's not to worry about.
Don't worry.
You don't really can't say what's going on.
It was lovely for me to go back into your memories that I could kind of touch on the tail end of from my time in Ireland. You talk about the sweets or the Quality Street. Or it's funny, though, these brands. You were saying, did I mention the Toblerone or the...
Yeah.
And there's the scones wrapped in, tea towel.
In the tablecloth, tea towel. And cutting the cross on the cake in order to let the fairies out. A lot of these were just folk traditions, if you like. But they were there and... You didn't have to believe them, but you could enjoy them.
And there was just so many great details. And so I feel like you could rebuild an archaeology, if that was, what was Ireland like then? Although I know, of course, it does go elsewhere, but it's focused on Ireland mainly. And, you could recreate from all these traditions and rituals and in a museum, like a museum of, I don't want to say the 50s, but a museum of that time. And what I liked was the absence of technology. We should talk a little bit about technology and education, because it's a reminder for people also that you do not need to be dependent on technology in the way that we are now. You can live a full life based on conversation, imagination, relationship, and community.
Yeah.
Which now we're coming back to that, but people have forgotten. You said so much now is lived through a screen, mediated through a screen, and people don't understand the world without the screen. And for you growing up, your screen was your eyes. Books to an extent, popular song or whatever, but it was yourself in the world, not an AI interpreter of the world who never set foot in the world, right?
Yeah. Well, I was reading a book about Paleolithic art recently, and the author said, from what we can work out, humans needed about 30 other individuals in their lives to get through life. And I thought, that's a very interesting mathematical puzzle. How many people do we actually need? If you count your parents and you count your close friends and some teachers, people who are significant to you, would you at this moment in life say, there's now 30 people in my life that gets me through? You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of meaning there. And perhaps by the time we find out enough to just have a let it be, or what the German philosopher called, or the mystic calls die Gelassenheit, is just letting things be, we're already through most of our life. But that's life. I mean, we didn't invent it. We enter it, we linger here, and we leave. And I hope that, it's slightly better for at least our friends.
And talk about friends. You mentioned there about teachers, the philosophers who've had an influence on you.
Yeah.
You just talk a little bit more about those.
Well, I mean, when I was studying, in 72, the philosophy I started studying, it was a very strange mixture. It was contemporary philosophy, so it was existentialism, phenomenology. So Sartre and Heidegger was very high on the curriculum. And also medieval philosophy, because it was in a religious setting. I was at St. Patrick's College, Maynooth. So that's where I was which seemed like a perfect place to read medieval philosophy, I must say. And so I enjoyed that very much. And I then continued philosophy studies until today. I still listen to lectures on YouTube every day. And so now I don't know what influences me anymore, because I don't own anything. It doesn't matter. You let your ego go. You are all the people you've ever met. You are all the names you have been called. And you are none of those names. Because you always have within yourself a sense that you're not just the fact of that signature. If you had signed it with an X because you couldn't read, it could still be accepted as your signature, right? And so people are complaining about the digitalized phenomenon of AI, which I think is just a huge competition for Google in terms of search and therefore advertising revenue, which just keeps simplifying things. So at the end, it's going to become so degraded as information, it will end the information age. And then a whole new way of having to live and understand things will need to emerge. But I think that, you know, if you think about our interconnections with each other and what we learn, then the pleasure is still learning, knowing how to learn. That's it. And you're doing it every day. And instead of the culture becoming information heavy, it becomes an oral culture. So I listen now to a lot of lectures on YouTube, which are fantastic. And particularly if you put in words in French or German, you don't just stay in the English-speaking world. It's remarkable what's available, and particularly in music. And you can say, oh, come on. I mean, haven't you read this, this, and this, or don't you know about this? So I think it's a very rich time, actually, for an oral culture to develop. That's the strange thing, that we can learn so much. Now, this is not about ersatz conversation, because obviously listening to people, this can't replace my meeting you in the cafe as we often did, face-to-face in Paris or in Dublin with David, having great conversations, doing things, sometimes a bit off the wall, whatever. But I mean, we've had that level of interaction, and that is community. Those are friendships that have gone on over.
That's a life.
That's a life, actually, isn't it? And he's been a great man. And a lot of his thinking, I think, he would see things in the book that he would recognize very well. You know, I mean, he often had this idea that, you know, the whole island was buzzing with sound, and it was a kind of like a schizophrenic affect, you know, in the air. And I remember him saying that. I rather liked it as an idea.
I think it's true. We can feel that, not just in Ireland with this information saturation. I think what you've pointed out, and I've heard people speculate, that this period of being a written culture, or primarily a written culture, that's maybe coming to an end. It's always going to be part of us, but then we're going back to an oral, or oral or video, or these
oral,
ephemeral.
Oral
visual.
Which reminds me, for example, I was reading a book about African art, and somebody said, well, you know, in this particular tribal situation, the woman's life was told by different kind of statues and carvings. So when she would have a mask at this age, then later there would be a mask with a child. Later there would be another object carved. And people understood the stories of people as much through objects that had been made as through actual tales told. And I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated that you could show or you could indicate, because a lot of what we're talking about is we're always trying to find meaning. We're always trying to find the truth. And that's why we can tell that people are lying too much, like in politics or so on. And, you know, if we didn't know truth, we wouldn't be able to tell they were lies, because a world in which everybody is a liar would make no sense. There would be no lies.
Yeah, so you're talking about there are different kinds of literacies. I do want to go into your painting. You've written about artists. You are an artist. I want to know how you entered into, you know, that's another language. And also even thinking, it kind of blows my mind, and I can't even imagine, you know, we're talking about different cultures, different languages within different cultures, but also within the animal world. Because I know that you are interested in primitive art and different ways of exploring and storytelling. And I just can't imagine, you know, what is the storytelling that we can't even decipher in that animal world? I mean, that's a big mystery, but...
Some people thought that bears were hibernating in caves, and they were scratching the walls when they woke up in the spring. and that then people came into the caves and they saw all these marks. And the way we do it, they started joining up. The way you do with the map of the sky at night, what reason is there to join? You make an image of a bear or a Leo or whatever. You say, oh, I'll join that star to this, this, and this, and that's a constellation. So in a way, the process of making constellations may be one of the earliest things we did in order to know where we were and to remember things we had done.
And what do you find through your, and you write very well about art, and also as you have that understanding as an artist, and, you know, this moment where you're free of the written language, you know, what do you discover within that?
I think what you have to discover all the time is freedom, you know, and that's it. I mean, for me, that's the truth of art, that you set something in, you make something that has not existed before, yeah? Much of it has existed, perhaps, or could be. You have this thing now in literary criticism about intertextuality. So we're all echo chambers. We're all kind of parroting. And I made a painting of the artist with a sick parrot. So that was my comment on culture, yeah?
Yeah.
Sorry, the anxiety of influence. There you are.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's called The Artist Who Has a Sick Parrot.
Yeah. Because we've so much culture. Lady Wilde said the hardest thing for a person to do is an act of their own.
Oh, well, you do that constantly. As I said, I wanted to show you because I was copying passages and I'm like, oh, I have to remember that one. I remember, but then the file got so big that I couldn't. It was like, yeah. Oh, it's just the whole book goes in that file.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's unusual, I think, for someone who, you know, academic, intellectual philosophers, maybe they have certain metaphors that they reach for, but they're not as alive in their senses, say, visually. You're kind of unusual and you're a polyglot in many ways, artistically and linguistically.
Chrissy Polly. That's also a parrot, isn't it? I should sit here.
You have a great ear and a great eye. Usually I find, oh, if they're really strong at writing, their other senses are dimmed. But the level, like even as we talk about your memory, your visual memory, your auditory memory, even your smells as well, you know, all these things are so strong and vivid in you.
In the book, I mean, something that fascinated me was trying to understand the layering of the senses. So at one point, even the count at the very opening says, well, you better use your nose to find out when it's cooked. I use my nose to smell when it's cooked. And it's been fairly accurate. I now manage to cook just by smelling things as to when they're ready.
Yeah.
And so I think it's just that. I mean, when we're talking about different literature, writing, anything, it's all about being able to imagine different ways of living and doing things. You know, I'm living on the margins and I was thinking about the word margin, and then it struck me that margins were where the first little figures, like troubadour figures in medieval manuscripts, they would draw them. And they were then considered outside the margin. So that's where you get outsider art. In other words, and that's a term almost of abuse, because it's like saying, oh, there's only one way to be an artist, and you've got to go to an art school, and you've got to go then and have a gallery, and then you have to have your own studio and atelier, because if not, and I think, what is this? This is a complete concoction. You know, the long history of art is over 15,000, 20,000, 45,000, 35,000 years of art. So it's been going on for so. This is our species behavior. We make art. There's no external mystery to this. Do you know what I mean? It's not some kind of extra consciousness. Yeah, we're art-making beings.
Yeah, I like that. The margins, outside the margins, I think about Beyond the Pale. I think about how you've wedded language with the visual, the senses, and thinking about Book of Kells and that old tradition. As you say, you embed it with all these stories within stories.
Stories, yeah.
You can open out each letter, each word can become a world.
Yeah, well, it's much better that you're saying this than that. If I said anything like that, I would be considered so immodest as to be unbearable. But if you say it, I have to both agree and say, well, that's a lot to say about anything, but you do come from somewhere. And I did see the Book of Kells as a child, and I was fascinated by But I was also fascinated by these little figures who are pulling at each other's beards. And I mean, the kind of irreverent drollery going on in the manuscript. And I discovered later with medieval manuscripts, I mean, if we date Kells, let's say, to the end of the 8th, early 9th century or something, you start getting this, you know, guys are sitting in a scriptoria and they're getting slightly bored and they start doodling. Now, that's the creative process, because you're daydreaming suddenly. You're supposed to be listening to the teacher, but you're watching the little motes of dust on the sunlight coming into the classroom, and you're getting exhausted because it's early spring and you just want to be outside. But in that boredom, in that mood, anything can happen. I mean, the whole imagination can just erupt at that moment when you think you've nothing in you. And that's beautiful.
I think it's the dreaming, isn't it?
It's the dreaming. It's allowing yourself to move between layers of being asleep, being awake, engagement with others.
But you were saying something with the Book of Kells.
Some of the marginal figures, some of the extensions out of the letters, you will have two figures interlaced, their legs intertwined, or they're pulling at each other's beards. Do you know what I mean? Or you have drolleries, you have jokes going on. But I think that they're meant to be marginal, and yet they somehow get absorbed into the whole decorative program itself. Yeah? And that's fascinating to see. And it's fascinating to know that the writing is itself almost being overwhelmed by the ornamentation and the decoration. There's this tension all the time. And that's a book that probably has never looked at. It's probably been closed for most of its existence. Keeps the colors fresher.
Yeah, we have to visit it in memory and reproduction. And I think in closing, because there's such a sense of the earth, I think that you really bring alive the language of the earth and the seasons and what it is to live in Ireland. You get that great atmospheric. So maybe in closing, could you share with us some memories of what you, whether they're childhood memories or the beauty and wonder of the natural world, what it's like you felt the wonder of what it is to be alive?
Yeah, why do I remember frosted mornings in late November? Yeah, when suddenly a frost might come and you would see a hedgehog. And then later you would see moles there, because in the lawn there would have been moles. I was fascinated by how did moles live in mud and underground? I could understand animals that tunneled, and I knew about rabbits' lairs and so on and so forth. But I couldn't quite understand how hedgehogs lived in and then sort of woke up and moved. And I would always see them on frosty mornings for some reason, or how blue tits would come and pick at the aluminium top of a milk bottle and leave little holes. How did they know there was cream there? So this kind of kept me preoccupied throughout my childhood. And so in a way, everything was a kind of sense of wonder and why things are the way they are. Why did my mother speak at the front door or on the telephone with a different voice than when she was speaking to us in the kitchen? Why did people behave differently when the priest came to visit? So all these different social relations. And I think because I was marginal, I'd go back to that analogy. I think growing up as a foster child, you are marginal. So you're like a kind of, you're in exile within a family situation, in a country where, of course, family values are so enormous, unmarried women are treated horribly and were. So there was all this double talk about respecting life and the sanctity of life, and then the horrible treatment of single mothers, which was pretty generic. I mean, it was a conspiracy of silence. There was an aggression towards any breach of that policed way of how you were supposed to, you know, exist indeed. Yeah. So that still is on my mind. I mean, I still remember that in a way.
All these things that one notices growing up and you return to, and you render them in a beautiful music. So thank you, Patrick Healy, for bringing us beyond the pale, showing us the beauty in the margins. By sharing your stories full of music, place, and memory, you remind us of the importance of childhood, how words create worlds, and what it is to be human. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you indeed. Thank you, Mia.
Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode was Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.